You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
Will the TFI revival mean a comeback for Reef?
Answer me this, answer me this.
Does Zadie Smith feel the pressure to maintain white teeth?
Answer me this, Helen and Ollie, answer me this.
You'll remember last episode we were discussing which city or country wouldn't be too hot or too cold, but just right for our very own Goldilocks, Pat from Canada. Well, Helen, you suggested Tasmania.
Yes.
Ben has said don't choose Tasmania.
All right.
I live there. And working
I don't want you anywhere near. Stay out.
And working outside this morning in Tasmania, it was -5 degrees Celsius.
Oof.
Bad suggestion, Helen.
Sorry.
I could have got that wildly wrong as well, because I'd never concentrated once in geography class. Literally not once.
Do you know where Tasmania is?
No.
You know where Tasmania is because in Neighbours, when they want somebody to go not too far, but far enough away, they never have to employ them again. They're like, oh yeah, she's gone to Tassie. Anyway, I thought in Tasmania there were various different climates, but sorry. Try and cancel the plane ticket, Pat. Someone called Unpopcult, who is on Twitter, says, how about Sucre or Chochabamba in Bolivia for Pat and her husband? Spring all year round.
Indeed, this town is known as City of Eternal Spring.
Oh, but she needs City of Eternal Autumn if she's retiring there, right?
Nice.
Rob suggests that Bogota in Colombia is the perfect location for Pat from Canada. The average temperature is 14.5 centigrade, 58 Fahrenheit. Other similar locations that are equatorial but at altitude would also suit her temperature needs. That is very smart. Mm. Equatorial for the constants, but high altitude for the coolness.
Reed says Pat from Canada can find a pleasant climate in Canada at Salt Spring Island in British Columbia. It
really?
Has a Mediterranean climate.
Unthinkable in Canada.
Yeah, I'm not sure this is right. And is close by to Victoria, the capital of BC, and Vancouver. If Pat prefers to be in a bigger place, then Victoria is always nice. You went and you thought it was just all right, didn't
you? Yeah, it wasn't that nice when we went on our honeymoon.
It was rainy.
Yeah, we went to the cinema and they started the film 40 minutes early, so we missed half of it. Yeah.
What was it?
Source Code.
That's really confusing to miss the first 40 minutes of Source Code.
Yeah, you can't watch Source Code having missed the beginning.
Well, we kind of worked out what had happened given the repetitive nature of the film. But then they gave us free tickets to Bridesmaids, so it worked out all right.
Oh, very good.
Nice $1.50 bill.
We've had another question of relocation from a lady in Israel, who prefers to remain anonymous, but says, I am a journalist and I write for a lifestyle magazine here in Israel. I do about 90% of my work via the internet from home, and I don't need to go into the office. Mostly I use Skype interviews, mail and internet research.
Much like doing this.
Yeah, it's astonishing to think this is how modern journalism operates, even in the Middle East, and yet the BBC spent millions moving people to Salford.
Well, Salford, you really have to experience from the ground.
Oh, absolutely.
Because otherwise, you don't get to go to the outlet mall.
That's right.
That online.
No, I mean, unlike in Israel, there's plenty of important news happening outside your door in Salford.
Yeah, if your door is where they film all the BBC news talking heads.
She continues, the last time I went to the office was 8 months ago.
Oh, good one, anonymous
lady.
Yeah,
I am now thinking, she says, about going abroad for a year or two, but I hesitate to ask my editors if that would be okay with them, especially since there are a lot of cutbacks and redundancies in the magazine.
But you've saved them so much money by not using their toilet roll.
She says, being able to work from virtually anywhere, I feel I could do my job adequately, even from the moon. So Helen, answer me this. Do I tell my editors I want to move and risk being fired, or do I not tell them, continue communicating with them via email and WhatsApp and stuff, and just visit every 3 or 4 months for the tasks that I can't do from afar?
Oh, well, when you put it like that, it seems like you'd be able to get away with it if you haven't seen them for 8 months.
I think don't deceive them by lying to them, because that will count against you. If they ask you outright, you have to tell them, but don't volunteer the information. It's not important where you are. As you point out, it's not affecting your day-to-day work.
And you could always pretend that you'd gone to follow a story that you hadn't got all of the information for yet, so you can't tell them what it is.
Maybe it's not that kind of magazine.
She says lifestyle. That's very broad.
That covers everything from Reader's Digest to Reader's Wives.
What if your lifestyle was being 5,000 miles from work? Easy.
If she moves house, though, she may legally have to provide a new address for invoices and stuff, and then that will flag it up. So it's going to come up. But I guess by that time, then it would possibly even be illegal for them to discriminate against you by firing you because you've changed address.
Could she get, say, a P.O. box, and she's saying she's only going to go abroad for a year or two.
Hmm.
That would probably work.
Yeah, but then if ever the editor wants to pop round for a cup of tea, you'll have to get a friend to dress up like Connie Booth pretending to be Sybil in Fawlty Towers.
Well, if she hasn't been there for 8 months, they might not even remember what she looks like. And it seems unlikely that the editor would pop round unannounced after such a long estrangement.
There is precedent in contemporary history for very renowned journalists writing about a city from a completely different country.
Yeah.
John Lahr, renowned American essayist, contributor to The New Yorker, profiler and all the rest, history as a Broadway theatre critic, lives in London.
Huh.
Does it all from London. So albeit he did live in New York for 20 years. But
how does he review theatre shows?
He doesn't anymore. He's more senior now.
Okay, so he doesn't just try and blag that.
No, but
it sounds like it's going to be shit.
It's Sondheim, which means none of the tunes are catchy.
But I think what he's...
Three stars.
What he's secretly done, I think, is... done profiles of people like Barry Humphries and Neil LaBute and kind of international theatre practitioners when they're in London, and then written it for a New York magazine as if it's because they're in New York. It's quite clever, really.
Yeah.
So, you know, average New Yorker reader wouldn't know he wasn't a New Yorker too.
Isn't there someone who does an overnight show on British radio who does it from Boston, Massachusetts?
Yeah, you say that like I wouldn't be aware of this, like I wasn't cursing him every day that I worked overnight.
It would have been perfect for you, 1 till 4 in the morning, if you'd been living in, say, Los Angeles, your dream place to live.
Yes, all right, Helen, some people have it better.
A lovely late afternoon job for you.
Yeah.
But if you'd been doing that and being like, oh yeah, London things from underneath your palm tree.
It's difficult, isn't it?
Yeah, getting into the character of someone reporting on the middle of the night London.
Yeah, cool. I think...
Isn't it difficult when you try and go surfing and there's not enough waves?
In London.
Oliver Thornton Flowers. Helen and Ollie, answer me this. Why are there no Greg the Bakers in Cornwall? I have a bet on with my best man, and it may result in me having the Greggs logo tattooed onto my bottom. So I'd like to know why there aren't any, so I can prove him wrong and save my bum.
Point one, do not make bets where a tattoo is the loser's outcome, or winner's, it doesn't make it clear. Point two, are there definitely zero Greggses in Cornwall?
There aren't any Greggs in Cornwall.
None.
No. There are none.
What about in neighbouring Devon?
There is one near Exeter, that's the closest.
Right.
There's a lot round Bristol.
So it's not a total West Country embargo.
No, it is specifically a Cornish one, and that is why there are some conspiracy theories out there. So let me outline it for you.
Okay, thank you.
And I imagine, Oliver, you with your bet with the best man, your debate is probably between these two different positions, and I'm going to come down on one side.
Okay.
So argument number one as to why there are no Cornish Greggs is, I suppose, what I'll call the pragmatic argument. That Cornwall is a relatively remote place within the UK. They'd need to build a bakery, you know, a factory, a centralised factory in the West Country to be able to supply all of those bakeries. And, you know, for example, there isn't one north of Aberdeen either. You know, when you get into slightly more remote places away from big cities, there aren't so many Greggs.
So there's no Greggs at either John O' Groats or Land's End.
Correct. However, where north of Aberdeen differs from, say, Penzance and St Ives, is there are fuckloads of tourists in Cornwall. And yes, it's seasonal, but it's for like 6 months of the year. So they could, theoretically, couldn't they, shift a lot of bread rolls at lunchtime and sustain a business.
Mm.
So that is why I come down on argument number two, that it's all about the Cornish pasty.
Mm.
The Cornish pasty is such an emblematic, iconic feature of
that
Cornwall.
Greggs wouldn't dare.
They wouldn't dare.
Well, more likely, just Cornish people wouldn't shop there. They'd shop with a local chain.
That they don't need the negative publicity of a rebellion, basically.
Yeah.
You know, because Greggs is a northern chain.
Right.
People up north love cheap food that makes you fat. You know, as they've gone down south.
Why would you say this?
I'm talking about the Greggs customer here. I doubt there's anyone listening in Sheffield who's going to disagree with that.
It sounded like you were being a little bit broader than that.
Well, as you come further south, Greggs has traded on that proud heritage as offering cheap snacks to... people who want the kind of sandwich that your nan would make at lunchtime. And in Cornwall, there would be a rebellion. There wouldn't be the enthusiasm that they see when they typically open a branch of Greggs and undercut the competition on the high street. You know, you think, oh, sandwich, only £1 instead of £3.50. There would instead be people saying, they're selling pasties, they're not even proper pasties because they're not made in Cornwall, and they're undercutting our local Cornish bakers.
What if Greggs did regional variations, as McDonald's is prone to do, and so they didn't sell pasties in Cornwall, but they still sold 8 sausage rolls and 8 donuts for a pound or whatever it is they do.
It's possible that would roll. Pardon the pun.
Oh.
But
Nonetheless, I still think it's the home of the pasty. The pasty, by the way, is a protected geographical indicative food now. So you can only actually call it a pasty if it's in Cornwall anyway. So Greggs have now called it a lattice.
Yeah, or a slice.
Yeah. So I just don't think, knowing that it's the company that makes the Thai chicken lattice, is not going to cut it in Cornwall. Here's a question from Pete in Ealing, who says, my ex-housemate, who lived with us for 6 months 2 years ago, was very religious. We no longer have any contact, except that at Easter, Christmas and New Year...
Is New Year a religious festival, really?
Well, that's a good point, isn't it? I suppose...
In Russia.
Roman. Yeah, you're right. It's not really in England, is it? Anyway, on Easter, Christmas and New Year, she will send me, and presumably the rest of her phone book, a very religious text message.
I wish he'd provided an example of a very religious text message.
I'm at best agnostic, says Pete, and don't really appreciate these messages, so Helen, answer me this. Short of replying with the word unsubscribe in block capitals, how do I get myself off her Christian mailing list without upsetting her on what is clearly a very important day for her?
Well, why can't you just block her number? If she's only contacting you for that, so you wouldn't be like you were missing out on other comms from her.
Can you do that?
Yeah, on iPhone you can.
Can you?
Yes.
So someone tries to text you and they say, yeah, I'm trapped down a well, you're my last chance.
Tough shit.
You're not going to get it.
Maybe Pete could start playing with her and rising the text messages, but creating a little counter narrative where he's like possessed by Satan or something.
Otherwise, I mean, me not being someone who knows how to block people's numbers.
Tech expert Ollie Mann.
I was just going to say, really, is it?
It's three texts you've got
exactly
to delete a year.
Yeah, is it really all that more irritating than PPI messages or discount deals to watch Frankie Boyle at the O2? You know, I think it's on a par. I get those and I look down and I think, ugh, that's an offer I'm not interested in. But I actually quite like being offered things that I'm not interested in, because
weird,
it's only by being offered things I'm not interested in.
You realise how rich you are in this life.
No, that you can qualify what you are interested in. I look at it and I think, well, I could be the kind of person who'd be interested in 40% off Frankie Boyle at the O2. I'm not. That's made me feel better about myself.
Mm. Yeah.
So, you know, when you get this text, just think, oh, that's a path my life could go down. I'm choosing not to. But ultimately, I would delete it rather than get in touch and ask them to take me off the list, because you don't want that embarrassing confrontation with them. Because they're not really thinking of you. As you say, Pete, when she texts it to you, she's really texting everyone in her phone book.
Well, you don't know that.
You
she could think
know
very special things about Pete and his godlessness. But I suppose, Pete, think it's not necessarily for you, it's for her. And allow
exactly
her this pleasure at these sacred times of year and also New Year that
exactly
is not sacred.
She thinks she's more likely to go to heaven by doing this. So let's
just
think that.
Just trying to help.
The truth is as well, that if this woman is anything like the guy who stands outside Leicester Square tube station singing from the Bible on a Saturday night, she's not going to listen to criticism. She's not going to take it on board. If you say, you know, good to hear from you, thanks very much, but actually, can you not send me these things every Easter? She's not going to change tack. She's going to carry on.
She's going to think he needs me even more.
Yeah.
Doesn't realise, but he does.
This is a challenge sent to test me.
Now, regular listeners will know that around this point of the show, we play a jingle with our email address in it to help you remember such an ungainly email address.
Don't reveal the tricks of the trade, Helen.
It was a pragmatic decision that became an artistic one. but listener Clem says, here's a version of your lovely jingle that I've made less lovely by creating it out of bits of other songs. Try to recognise the artist.
Amazing. So it's a plug for our email address and a game at the same time.
And a copyright nightmare. Thanks, Clem. Here it is.
If you got a question, then email your question to answer.
This podcast and
I'll
come
answer me this
If you were playing along at home, you can find out who was in it. Queens of the Stone Age.
Them Crooked Vultures.
Madeleine Peyrou.
Radiohead.
Oh, yeah. Elvis.
Chet Baker.
Muse. Oh.
C.W. Stone King.
Who's that?
I don't know who that is.
No, I don't know who
it's
that
whoever
is.
Was before Ella Fitzgerald.
The Beatles.
Rufus Thomas.
Rage Against the Machine.
Elvis Costello.
Screaming Jay Hawkins.
Ooh.
Eminem.
Elton John.
And Nirvana.
Martin got Nirvana, well done.
You got Nirvana.
You're the real muso, Martin.
I found it a bit disorienting.
Here's a question from Will from the DC metro area, who says, I genuinely enjoy spending time with my siblings.
That's nice.
One of them has moved away,
aww,
my older brother, whilst the other is currently living at home. my older sister.
Yay.
This is a bit like a round robin, isn't it?
One of them is no longer in the DC metro area.
Yeah.
The other one is.
However, continues Will, whenever my sister and I are out doing something, like going to the Renaissance Festival or watching the Six Nations tournament in a bar, people we don't know seem to assume that we are in a relationship, even if we're with a small group.
How would you know?
I know this because on multiple occasions, people, mostly men, have explicitly addressed me under the assumption that I was her boyfriend.
Ooh.
Hmm.
It has happened to me sometimes. People have assumed that I am my brother Andy's wife.
Really?
Because we both have the surname Zaltzman. I wonder whether they assume that when he's out with my dad, they're married because they have the same surname.
Everyday sexism.
As you might imagine, continues Will, this all feels rather uncomfortable to me, and it just bothers me to think that random people are assuming we're a couple. It's not like we're affectionate with one another, heaven forfend, or hold hands, or some shit.
Girls, cooties, gross!
Beyond the fact that it just makes me feel gross, it also puts me in the weird position of inadvertently warding off her potential suitors, for lack of a better term. On the other hand, continues Will, there have been at least two occasions where men have asked me if it's all right if they flirt with her, which I guess is considerate.
Why don't they ask her?
Exactly, yeah. I tell them it's none of my business, and then they proceed to act like sexist assholes or the world's worst pickup artists.
So it probably is good that you're there, usually, to deter them.
Everything about this, says Will, feels uncomfortable and icky. So, Helen, answer me this. I'm glad he's asked this to you, because, of course, I don't have a brother or a sister or
none
a care
of this
in the world.
No.
How can I dispel these assumptions without being weird about it or having to explicitly tell people she's my sister? I don't think wearing a shirt that says I'm her brother would go down well.
I wonder how this is a big problem, because very rarely do I have this with my brothers.
Mm.
And I think it's because we don't act in a touchy-feely way with each other or in any way to indicate we're a couple. Maybe they cuddle a lot. I don't know. So
he said they don't.
He said that they don't.
He said they don't hold hands or any of that shit. I think that would definitely cover hugging.
They just kiss a lot.
I actually think what it might be, and I'm saying this as someone who is an only child, in my experience of people who do have siblings, generally speaking, grown adults aren't that close to their siblings. Now, that's not the same all over the world, of course, but I'm talking about London here, and I imagine DC, therefore, quite a work-orientated professional environment as well, quite
DC
similar.
DC metro area, Ollie.
Still. I imagine it might be the case that generally you meet adults in a bar and they're not with their brothers and sisters. And so the general public around you are probably going to assume that you are, first of all, a couple. If not a couple, you are perhaps colleagues. And if not colleagues, just friends, before they jump to the conclusion of brother and sister. That is how my brain works when I meet two adults together.
Well, statistically, it's much more likely that they would be friends or lovers or colleagues than...
Because the brother and sister. Because the parents aren't there. If you saw a family together, then you'd know.
Well, also, just most people have more friends than they have siblings.
Exactly.
Unless they
have very few friends.
Yeah.
Maybe you're right. Maybe this is an evening bar situation, whereas if you were somewhere in the day, it wouldn't necessarily be such a surprise.
Still, if you saw a grown man and grown woman sitting on a park bench together enjoying a sandwich, you'd still, in that order, I think, you'd think couple, colleagues, friends.
But I think maybe there's something about the body language. It doesn't have to be, like, touchy-feely, but... I think there's probably a certain amount of relaxation you have around someone that you've known your whole life.
That familial.
But I think maybe that's what it is. People just see that relaxation, and maybe there's like mutual like laughter and that kind of thing that you have with anyone that you're close to.
For me, it horrifies me more than when people might assume that my brothers and I are a couple than when people assume you and I are a couple, Ollie. That's the worst to me.
Although, now that's an interesting point. People,
no offence, not about you. It's just more about our relationship.
Sure, it's not about me. It's just about the way that you hate me.
Yeah.
But
it's a very special targeted hate.
But actually, I don't find it surprising when people think we're brother and sister.
No, not at all.
Yeah, that makes more sense.
In fact, we do have quite a siblingly relationship in that I don't feel the need to be polite to you at all.
Yeah, noted.
Easy solution for Will, but it would still involve the other people making a snap judgment about him, would be for him to pretend that he's gay.
Yeah, but then there's quite a lot of artifice going on in this evening.
Yeah, but it seems like that's where we're going.
And actually, we don't know he's not gay.
That's true.
So he could be gay and people are still reaching this conclusion. That doesn't help. I think what you have to do, Will, and this is the best I'm going to give you, I'm afraid, is you have to, and you know, you might think this is sexist, but whatever. I think you have to introduce her as your sister to everyone. So you have to say, hey, have you met my sister, whatever her name is.
Just examine your body language, Will. You don't have to hold hands to look intimate. I think just look a bit uncomfortable together and that will probably work.
That's what most couples are like, isn't
it?
Yeah. Just imagine you have been married for 10 years.
If I'm out with my grandmother, my father and my mother.
That is a hot pack of mans.
but not my girlfriend. People look at that foursome and assume that my father and my grandmother are married because my father looks his age. My grandmother looks about 15 years younger than her age.
I think younger than that.
So the same age roughly as my dad actually is. And my mum also looks about 15 years younger than her actual age. So it looks like, basically, and because I look a bit older than my age, I think, it looks like me and my mum are roughly the same age. Maybe my mum's like 5 years older than me. So people assume that me and my mum are a couple.
I would never
assume.
My dad
and my grandma are a couple. And everyone thinks that's funny apart from my dad.
But he's the luckiest one. Because
he's actually screwing the person who looks like they're 35.
And also Terry's a hot piece, so your dad has it always. I wouldn't assume that you and your mum are a couple because you're dressed as if you wouldn't even go in the same circles.
Yes, basically, shorthand for you listeners, I'm dressed as Safi from Absolutely Fabulous and she's dressed as Adina.
Yeah, and Patsy in one.
And my dad's dressed as Elliot Gould and my grandma's dressed as Joan Rivers. That's basically the look.
It's an eye-catching group, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
Apart from you two guys who are letting it down.
Yeah, I guess.
Ladies and gentlemen, we now present The Intermission, brought to you today by Episode 29. Available now at answermethisstore.com.
Hugo says, Helen, answer me this. Recently, I received a soaking... courtesy of a rain shower while cycling to work.
What a bitch.
My top was fine, but I'd forgotten waterproof trousers. What are the point of waterproof trousers?
I think you'll find in the course of this question what the point is, Oliver.
But they're so ridiculous.
Let's not mention the fake leather trousers that you had.
That's the disadvantage,
from the discount
listeners.
Shopping of, village in Bicester.
The disadvantage, listeners, of doing any kind of entertainment device with anyone that you've known for more than a few years is that they can drag up these things from your late teenagers. Thank you, Helen.
Late teenager, you're in your 20s.
Yes, thank you.
Hugo, continue.
They were cheap. They were 30 quid.
They were not cheap. Something horrible is not a bargain. Please get your legs dry in a shower.
Hugo continues. You remember Hugo, listeners. He's the one that sent us that question, that he was in a rain shower on the way to work, that he'd forgotten his waterproof trousers, so he bought some replacements and left his own trousers to dry at work. At the end of the day, I took the new trousers back for a refund.
Ooh.
Is this morally wrong, or am I justified in my actions?
Well, interesting. It depends whether you think clothes shops are a library or not. Listeners, please do dump your questions on the question line, which you can call by dialing the following number.
0208 123 5877.
Or by Skyping, answer me this.
I'm Adam from London. Helen and Ollie, answer me this. With my limited experience of film premieres, I was wondering, do the stars actually go in and watch the film in the cinema like a regular punter?
Star of the films, Channing Tatum, said in a Reddit AMA this very week, he was giving out a competition for somebody to come to the premiere of Magic Mike XXL with him, because he was saying no one ever goes, it's just publicists and stuff who are actually inside the film. But you get to go with him and a bunch of publicists to see the film, which presumably means he's going to be sitting through it.
He will sit and watch it. It often depends, frankly, on whether or not there's another press opportunity after the screening. Like, so for example, there'll be a Q&A often on stage with the director or something, won't there? Often a very soft one, because obviously it's being paid for by the film's publicity team.
What?
So there'll be a journalist who's paid to say how great it is and ask them unthreatening questions. But if that's happening on stage after the film's screening, then sometimes the talent have to be there for that.
Yes.
But I reckon they'll often fuck off into Chinatown, don't you think, for a sticky fried rice and come back for the
Q&A. Lovely.
Yeah.
Lovely.
Because they've seen it.
Also, a lot of people can't bear to watch themselves on screen. Like Al Pacino, he's like, well, once the film is done, you just can't do that because it's too late to change it.
I love it when film stars say that, because it's just the worst possible publicity, you know, even though you understand where they're coming from.
It's not watching that shit.
Yeah, it's like Woody Allen's publicity for the Amazon stuff he's been making. Have you heard him?
It's where he's like, it's torture, it's awful.
Yeah. This was the worst decision of my professional life.
I think I can find worse.
It's just the worst possible negative campaign to run beforehand. Yeah. But yeah, it somehow works for him, doesn't it?
So, I mean, I guess like a London premiere is a relatively big deal, but like how many premieres must they have to go to?
Yeah. And they go to so many now. Yeah. Well, now
like
they have
Seoul.
And all of it, after all, if you're a big American star, is just the European leg. You know, you've already done 5 openings in the US.
Yeah, and then the Asian market is big now.
And let's be honest, Magic Mike XL, or is it extra large?
XL. Yeah, they all wear very big T-shirts.
It's not a film that's designed to be seen more than once, even for the protagonist, I should imagine.
I don't know. I'd bet there were some women who would disagree with you.
I thought the first one was meant to be very good.
The first one is very good.
Is it Steven Soderbergh?
It is Steven Soderbergh, yeah. And it is an entertaining and dramatic piece of fiction.
I only saw a few minutes from the very end. It seemed to be a lot of staring up Matthew McConaughey's Norge. But how many times do you think you could stomach sitting through your own film before you just became profoundly depressed?
I've listened to episodes of Answer Me This that we're in the process of putting together or resubmitting for something at most 5 times before feeling nauseous.
Yeah, so you wouldn't make it even outside of the USA leg of premieres.
Well, also, if you're the director, then you've sat in a cutting room probably 500 times. I mean, it must be unbearable. You're just watching it thinking, oh, well, that's a bit crap, isn't it? We should change that bit. Or you can still see the line on his hair.
Wish I hadn't used that Nord shot.
But then again, if there's supposed to be an audience reaction, if it's a comedy or a musical, then actually it's probably quite nice to see it with people who haven't poured millions of dollars into the film and are worried that it's no good. Like, it must be quite nice if you see it with a room full of people and they genuinely jump with terror or laugh.
But if it's a room full of publicists who are just like, oh, just waiting for the free booze.
Publicists are human beings too, Helen.
I know, but if they're working late, often, if they're going to a premiere.
Apparently often as well, it's people who have given favours to the film. The caterer or the insurance person, they're the people that get the free seat in exchange for their work. So it's like an extra little sweetener you can do when you're trying to blag stuff, basically. Well, do you want tickets to the premiere? You know, or you can give them away as competition prizes.
Yeah, but do they specify which premiere?
No.
Like, if it's not one of the good ones.
I think every premiere now is quite good in the sense that it's a good party. Like, the stakes have been raised because, I guess, in the old days, you know, pre-internet, the European premiere wouldn't be actually seen by people in America. But now, you know, pictures of Tom Cruise standing in Leicester Square get beamed back to California instantly, don't they? It's pretty much dressed up like a theme park set.
To cover up the Leicester Squareness of it all.
Yeah, but there's acrobats, there's rock bands. I mean, it's full on. It's not just like some stars on a carpet anymore. It's a proper show.
Yeah, it's because they need the coverage.
Yeah,
it's just not an interesting story.
No, it's not, is it? Yeah, film opens.
Yeah.
I mean, that effectively now just means a file has been sent to a computer.
Something may appear on Netflix in 2 months.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, here is another question of cinema from Callum, who seems to have been provoked into writing in because of your mention of the Milton Keynes point in Answer Me This, episode 314. He says, Ollie happened to mention that Milton Keynes point was the first multiplex cinema in the UK. This immediately took me back to childhood memories of the Unit 4 cinema in Wallasey on Merseyside. Mm-hmm. This had 4 screens and later extended to become the Apollo 6. Now, I'm not sure of the dates, but I was certainly going to the Unit 4 in the mid to late 70s, and it was a bit old and grotty then. That was the style of the 70s, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was, yeah.
So it must have opened way before the point opened, which Google says happened in 1985.
It did indeed happen in 1985. And closed in 2015, by the way. The point is no longer with us, yeah.
Oh, that recent, though?
Yeah.
Anyway, says Callum, I don't want to big up the Unit 4, as it was certainly no modern multiplex. I once described it to my friends as like sitting on the side of a mountain watching a portable TV. That's very evocative. But it did have a bar, fruit machines, and vastly overpriced hot dogs and sweets. So, Ollie, answer me this. Why does the Unit 4 not qualify as a multiplex cinema?
Because it only had 4 screens. That's why. The definition by the industry of a multiplex cinema is a purpose-built cinema with 5 or more screens.
Right. And just by being early at a time where people may have not been acquainted with the idea of there being 5 screens, it's still not going to rescue itself by having 4.
No, well, I don't think in truth there are that many cinemas with 5 screens when you think about it. I think the reason the level was set at 5 is because actually there were quite a lot. Sorry to dash your childhood dreams. There were quite a lot of cinemas around the country with 4 screens. Because if you think about it, what there were all over the country, you know, in the 30s and 40s, were these huge auditoria that had 2 levels, right? One big screen. And so obviously what happens as the 70s comes along and cinema attendances drop is you turn the stalls of the theatre into 2 screens and you turn the circle, the gallery, into 2 screens.
Right.
It's quite easy to make a 4-screen cinema out of a 1-screen big cinema. You wouldn't typically be able to fit 5 because then you've got cinemas that have only got 20 seats in. They're not profitable.
Asymmetrical.
Yeah. Well, they need a certain minimum number of seats to make money.
Although I love Screen 5 at the Brixton Ritzy. Armchairs,
that's a good one.
Tables... lot of leg room,
but
never
a modern
anyone
modern
there.
Renovation. You see, in the old days, that would have been renovated to a 4 at most. So the level was set at 5, but actually, the point opened with 10. So, I mean, it blew Merseyside out of the park immediately. Imagine what that must have been like. You've only ever been in a cinema that has three or four screens.
There would have been 10 films out at a time back then.
Yeah, but actually, I mean, that's the problem with multiplexes, isn't it? You know, yes, they revived the British cinema-going experience, but it's mostly people seeing the same Star Wars reboot in five different screens. The whole point was supposed to be, you know, you'd have an arty film in screen one and a naughty film in screen two and a kids film in screen three and a sci-fi film in screen four. And then you'd have
a documentary no one wants to watch, screen five.
Exactly. And then you'd have in the other five screens the big blockbuster. But actually, it's just all the blockbuster, isn't it? It's just Harry Potter in every screen starting 20 minutes later and in different forms of dimensional representation. And it always has been.
That explains why Milton Keynes' points 10 screens are no longer with us.
No, it doesn't. What explains why Milton Keynes' 10 screens are no longer with us is the continuing evolution of the multiplex. Audiences want more, Helen, and you simply cannot fit into the point an IMAX size screen, which is what the modern multiplex attendee wants.
Is it?
Yeah.
I don't think I've ever wanted an IMAX screen.
No, well, you'd be the customer who'd go to that cinema because you'd think, oh, that's the cool cinema. And you'd choose not to pay the extra for the IMAX, but you'd still choose the one, potentially, market research says. I mean, you personally
would. Why are you suggesting that I'm such a sheep?
I'm not. But a lady in your age category and background would be more likely to choose the one with the IMAX screen because they'd think it was cutting edge, even if they chose not to pay the extra for the 3D and the IMAX.
I don't want my edges to be cut.
Yeah, well.
Telford's getting a new IMAX.
There you go. Nothing says this story that I'm telling you better than Telford's getting a new IMAX. This is how cinemas develop, is what I'm telling you.
Yeah.
Do you know that a lot of them now, I think there's only two in the country, but they're trying to expand it, are having these D-box seats.
Excuse you.
Which is...
Your D-box.
Kind of theme park-style simulator seats.
Oh, like sort of 4D cinema.
Yeah. And it's in a couple of screens, and the idea is like, watch along and become immersive with the film.
They're just like broken massage chairs, aren't they?
Yeah, well, look, I get it for Indiana Jones, but for Pride and Prejudice, it's a bit weird.
Look, it spray you with water when he goes in the lake.
Yeah.
Yo, yo, one love. The best thing about tennis is the women's tennis, women's tennis. Hearing those ladies all going makes me go in my pants.
Answer Me This Sports Day, out now at answermethispodcast.com/albums.
Here's a question from Kat, who says, Helen, answer me this. Why is a groom, as in bride and groom, called a groom? Is there any connection to a horse and groom or to grooming oneself?
No. The horse groom is from the Middle English for young man, because presumably it would be young men that had that job, or boys.
If there was any connection, it would be insulting to the bride, wouldn't it? If you were, then the bride would be the horse in that equation.
It's more appropriate for her stylist.
Yes, absolutely.
Than her husband.
Yeah.
But groom is from bridegroom, which is from the old English word breed gooma, which meant suitor, as in the gooma meant man, and the breed was woman who is going to be married.
What was the word?
Bridegooma.
So it still means, really, bride and suitor of the bride.
Yeah.
Mm.
The thing what's interesting about it, I find, is that from a proprietorial sense, the father giving away the wife and the wife then becoming the ownership of the man, you know, it is traditional, but it's something that now seems sexist. And yet, the word bridegroom, actually, out of all of the words associated with weddings, that almost suggests the man is kind of more property of the woman.
Well, naturally.
Yes, for a very brief period.
Yes, sure. No, I understand. But do you know what I mean? It's quite interesting. It's actually oddly emasculating, isn't it? You know, what's your role here? I'm the bridegroom. You know, or rather like I'm the bride stylist and I'm the bridesmaid. I'm the bridegroom. I'm just part of the bride's day, basically, yeah.
After that brief time of him being subordinate, she was then his legal property.
A lifetime of cooking and cleaning and sex on demand.
And drudgery and popping out children till she died. Good time. Happy wedding season, everybody.
Well, here's a question from John in Melbourne, who says, we have a friend who is a reformed alcoholic and no longer drinks grog.
Kind of goes with the reformed alcoholic.
It does, doesn't it?
Yes,
yeah. In a way, you're proving your earlier statement. He recently invited us over for dinner, and we weren't sure whether to take along a bottle of wine to share with the other guests or whether to just take some soft drinks. In the end, we decided to just take soft drink. Someone else took wine for others to share and a bottle of non-alcoholic champagne for the host.
Don't know whether that's a good move, because often people who are trying to stay away from booze don't want things that are booze-like.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Helen, answer me this. When one is sharing a meal with a reformed alcoholic, is it okay to drink wine and ignore their weakness, or should you avoid producing wine altogether and possibly offend them by highlighting their weakness?
Highlighting their weakness? It's your weakness if you can't get through an evening without wine.
Arguably, but then
It takes a lot of strength to give up something.
Yeah, no, I agree. I don't take issue with you taking issue with his use of the word weakness.
Good!
But...
my issue is right.
Fine. But I wouldn't say necessarily it is weakness to bring wine along to a dinner party. It is convention.
Yes, but I think it'd be different at a restaurant. I think it would be okay to order drinks there, but bringing it into someone's home...
If he was halal, you wouldn't bring bacon bites, would you? I think that's the rule. Yeah.
And if they're vegetarian, hopefully you would find it in you not to bring a bag of raw meat. Like, do you mind just sticking this in the oven for me? Because I can't last for 2 hours without my meat. So I think the easy get out of this is to take a nice box of chocolates.
Yes, I agree. Although if everyone brings chocolates, then you've got too many chocolates.
Yes, but then they can give them away as a present later.
Josh from Reading, I think. Helen and Ollie, answer me this. When did Leningrad change its name back to St. Petersburg? Because I found out at this party, he says, like, a year or two ago. But I think it was way before that.
It was before that, Josh. Well done, you win. It was 1991 at the end of the Soviet Union that they changed Leningrad back to St. Petersburg. Which
are there still Russians who call it Leningrad?
They're
clinging on desperately to
there is a movement led by the head of the Communist Party, Gennady Zyuganov.
It's okay that you paused there just before saying his name, because in the future we can edit in whoever the current leader is before they get assassinated. It's
they'll edit it in themselves. he wants to bring back Leningrad and Stalingrad. But Petersburg was founded in 1703 by Peter the Great. He called it Sankt Petersburg because he wanted it to sound Dutch, because he wanted the city to be like one of the grand port cities of Western Europe, because he really wanted that influence in Russia. So like Amsterdam, he was very keen on. And then in 1914, they changed it from St. Petersburg to Petrograd because they thought St. Petersburg sounded too German, and obviously they weren't getting on too well at the time. And then after the death of Lenin in 1924, they changed it to Leningrad to celebrate him.
So, Peter the Great, really, naming it after himself, really.
Yeah. But during the time it was called Leningrad, apparently the locals still called it Peter, so I suppose these things stick. And I think in 1991 there was a vote amongst the populace to see whether they wanted to change it back, and they did.
Here's a question from Talib in Monaco, who says, I was reading an article about a bunch of hippies. Do you think from Monaco everyone just seems like a bunch of hippies?
Bunch of hippies running the British government.
Bunch of hippies that pay their taxes.
Who had inadvertently done a big Mercedes sign instead of a peace sign. They are kind of similar, aren't they? I never really thought about that.
But it's easy to convert a Mercedes logo into a peace sign. It's only one more pen stroke.
Yeah.
Maybe you saw an unfinished peace sign.
So, Helen, answer me this. Why is the symbol of peace a three-pointed star in a circle with a line at the bottom? When was that adopted? Does it predate hippies?
It does predate hippies because it was first used at Easter 1958 when there was the first big anti-nuclear march in the UK. It was from London to Aldermaston in Berkshire, which was the site of the Atomic Weapons Research Establishment. So the Direct Action Committee Against Nuclear War and the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament, which we know as CND, teamed up, had this march, and the logo was designed by a graphic designer called Gerald Holtham because they thought there should be some symbol to unify the whole march. So they had like 500 round placards with the symbol on, and it was on the banners, and they had little ceramic badges with it on. And there are two explanations for why it looks like it does.
So it looks like a tree to me.
Like an upside down tree or like a tree with roots?
Oh, I
don't
know which way around is it supposed to be. Oh, I see, right. Okay.
Forked at the bottom.
Oh, okay.
So the common explanation is that the symbol is the semaphore for N and D, meaning nuclear disarmament. The N is like the two little angular bits at the bottom and the D is the straight line. But Gerald Holtham also said that he drew himself in deep despair, so a forlorn-looking stick figure, and then put a circle around it. So believe what you will. But apparently this symbol may have predated Gerald Holtham because it also appears on the graves of SS soldiers who died in World War II. Not so peaceful there.
Well, I suppose it's a star, really, isn't it? I mean, actually, that's what it looks like the most. The Mercedes logo was based on a star.
Yeah, but this doesn't look like a star because it's very bottom-heavy.
But it looks like the Mercedes logo. So, you know, the reason why you're going to find any kind of element in history that looks a bit like it is because it does look a bit like a star. It's a basic shape, isn't it?
Yeah, but you can see how it became successful because it's very easy to replicate and for hippies to draw on their stuff and very recognisable.
And yet VW somehow managed to colonise the hippie vehicle market. How did Mercedes not capitalise on that? They make vans.
Yeah, I suppose. Too expensive.
Yeah, I guess.
Error.
In the original Mercedes logo, the three elements of it, I mean, I think with these things, they was reverse engineer it afterwards, don't they, and pretend it stood for something that it didn't. Mm. As I say, really, it's a star. But the three elements of it, they say, were because the company's ambitions were to go on land, sea and air.
And how's that going for them? Have they managed to do the flying hovercraft yet?
I'm pretty sure there's a Mercedes component in an aeroplane somewhere, yeah. I'd imagine they've achieved that.
I'm sure they supply the Luftwaffe at one point or another.
Yeah, probably. Yeah.
And they designed my school bus, so that's land covered.
It's their most famous achievement, isn't it?
Luftwaffe, yeah. Helen school bus.
Yeah, yeah.
That brings us to the end of this episode of Answer Me This. But if you want to baguette another episode of Answer Me This, not baguette, then please send us your questions via email, phone or Skype. And our contact details are on our website.
AnswerMeThisPodcast.com.
On there as well, you can find links to follow us on Twitter and Facebook to be our online friend.
Yes, although actually, something I should say, I've now set up my own Facebook page as well.
Ooh, how's that going?
It's all right. I've got, in 2 weeks, I'm going to sound blasé now to people that are listening that have got like 20 friends. Got 960-something likes.
That does seem good.
It's okay. Good. But we've got thousands of listeners. I just expected a healthier number. So anyway, I'm telling you now, listeners, Facebook.com/OllieMann.
Yeah, but Facebook.com/AnswerMeThis, because a fraction of our listeners actually like this show on Facebook.
Yes, that's true. Yeah, we'll do both.
And do visit our website for additional questions that were not in the show and some of your feedback that you send in. And every other week when there's no Answer Me This, there's a post with other stuff that we've been in and other stuff we've been listening to.
That's right.
Yes.
All that remains is for us to remind you to go to AnswerMeThisStore.com as well to buy our stuff and support our show.
And please join us again in 2 weeks.
Bye! Helen and Ollie.